The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode of the Lawfare podcast is supported by the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. Law school that fits your life, full-time, part-time, online, and in person. Learn more at mitchellhamlin.edu. That's mitchellhamlin.edu.
Three of them were classified before Michael Ellis's recent review. One of them was classified by Ellis during his review before he learned how to classify. And the other two, the lawyer had not yet figured out who classified them and when.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 22nd, 2020. You may have heard that former National Security Advisor John Bolton has a book out. His White House memoir, titled The Room Where It Happened, has made a lot of waves recently. Not only has Bolton faced criticism for publishing his account of his time in the Trump administration in a book, rather than testifying in the president's impeachment trial, but the Justice Department is now suing Bolton for publishing what it claims is classified information. So what exactly is the government arguing? And is Bolton's book even any good? We brought together Benjamin Wittes, Jack Goldsmith, and Marty Lederman to discuss. One note before we begin. As you'll hear, we recorded this on Friday, June 19th. The judge in Bolton's case issued a ruling denying the government's motion for a temporary restraining order blocking distribution of Bolton's book on Saturday, June 20th. But we still think it's a good conversation that gives you useful context on what's going on. In his Saturday ruling, Judge Royce Lamberth of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia found that he would not block the release of Bolton's book. Lamberth did say that Bolton's unilateral conduct raises grave national security concerns, and wrote that Bolton could face civil and even criminal liability for going ahead with publication without government approval. But the judge ruled that the government had failed to establish that a restraining order was appropriate, in large part because, he said, the horse is already out of the barn. Bolton's book is due to be published on Tuesday, June 23rd, and copies have already shipped to bookstores and reviewers. For reasons that hardly need to be stated, Judge Lamberth ruled, the court will not order a nationwide seizure and destruction of a political memoir. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 22nd. John Bolton's book is out of the barn.
So let's start with the basics. It's not unheard of for former national security advisors to put out books, but I think it's probably fair to say that usually those books are not a major national event in which the president gets involved. So, Ben, you've spent your last 24 hours reading the book. Why is everyone going bananas over John Bolton right now?
Well, everyone's going bananas over John Bolton because of two things. One is the perception, which I share, that to the extent he had information bearing on the fitness of the president to be in office, the appropriate forum for him to deliver that was not a book, but was congressional testimony, which he declined to give back last fall. And then secondly, because buried in this long and rather turgid book is a fair bit of information that would have been germane to the impeachment proceedings, both in the sense of rounding out our understanding of the Ukraine affair, which Bolton had some visibility onto, but actually probably more importantly than that, in perhaps expanding the focal length of the lens, one of the arguments that he makes, very much in passing, but it is there, is that the behavior that the president engaged in the Ukraine affair was not limited to the Ukraine affair, and that he asked Xi Jinping to intervene in the election to the 2020 on his behalf, and that he corrupted or sought to corrupt Justice Department investigations of the Halk Bank that was of concern to President Erdogan of Turkey. And there were sort of similar machinations with respect to investigations of ZTE and Huawei. And so part of what he's arguing, he describes it at one point as obstruction of justice as a way of life, and concerned him enough that he raised it both with Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, and with Bill Barr, the attorney general. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff in this book, and one of, you know, it is not a particularly elegantly put together piece of work product, but embedded in it is a kind of expanded, devastating portrait of the president that would have dovetailed very closely with some of the allegations that were made in the impeachment context.
So the other part of why this is getting a lot of attention, as you know, Ben, is that the government is currently suing Bolton to try to limit the distribution of his book. Jack and Marty, you've both been paying pretty close attention to this. You've written a couple pieces over the last few days for Lawfare and Just Security. Would one of you be able to just give us the sort of top line about what the litigation is about, and then we'll come back down to that later in the podcast?
The principal focus right now, between now and Tuesday, which is the official publication date of the book, is whether a federal district judge should issue an injunction, particularly to John Bolton himself, to prohibit him from publishing the book. There's another issue involved, which is at some point, can the government collect all the profits that he makes on the book? But the big issue between now and Tuesday is whether the court can issue an injunction. Now, in the ordinary, now most listeners might think typically judges cannot restrain publication of books. That's a prior restraint, and the First Amendment has something to say about that. But when it comes to government officials such as Jack and myself and Ambassador Bolton, who we were given access to classified information on a condition that we would not do certain things, you know, for the rest of our lives with the information that we learned. So we signed contracts to that effect. And where that is the case, the law, the First Amendment law, can be different. The courts can play more of a role in restraining people, as they can in enforcing all contracts, from talking about things that they've promised not to talk about. And that's the way the government is framing this case. The problem here is that Bolton has already done what the government wanted him not to do. He gave the manuscript to his publisher, Simon & Schuster, gave them a green light early in May to go ahead with their publication schedule, which is scheduled for next Tuesday. And Simon & Schuster does what publishers do all the time with big ticket books these days. They sent out copies to booksellers, to the press, to Amazon, to send around to persons who purchase it on Amazon. And apparently Amazon and other online providers have started probably to send out copies of the book. Ben has a copy of the book. One of the more interesting parts of today's hearing was the debate about which metaphor was best here. Is it the horse has already left the barn, or the toothpaste can't be squeezed back into the tube, or what have you? An injunction here would appear not to be able to help the government. The government's basic theory here is that there are six passages in the book that will reveal very close secrets to foreign governments and foreign officials that they should not know. if that's the government's interest, there simply seems to be no way of remedying that at this point. So that's the most important thing about today's hearing is the futility function. This just seems like there's no possible way to advance the government's interests now that this has happened. And that was the first question that Judge Lamberth asked the government's lawyer, which is basically, why are we here? How can we possibly help you? Haven't you already been injured? The government lawyer's very interesting answer was, Mr. Bolton himself is a creative man. I hope I'm not caricaturing this. He's very creative. And if you tell him he has to take all the steps within his power to stop the harm from occurring, there are many things that he might come up with to try to solve this problem. And on Twitter and elsewhere, everyone was wondering, what does he have, like, I don't know which cartoon character is Superman or someone or Back to the Future or The Matrix or something, going back into time and erasing these books and the knowledge that foreign officials have already learned from the book. It was a really strange sort of answer. What did you think, Jack, of that?
Yeah, I agree that the government gave an unpersuasive answer to Judge Lamberth's question, which is basically, as you said, how can I stop you from being injured here? The book is already out. And I think the government was basically arguing, well, Bolton can take steps to ameliorate the harm. He can stop Amazon from publishing it next Tuesday. He can stop Audible from allowing downloads and the like. But I think that answer was completely non-responsive. Basically, the injury is complete to the government as soon as our foreign adversaries and or anyone really can read this classified information, the alleged classified information in the book. And that harm has already happened. Ben has a copy. The publisher says that hundreds of thousands of copies have been shipped around the globe. Many, many people have already read it. So the idea of ameliorating the harm doesn't make any sense. The harm is already complete. And I think that that's what Judge Lamberth will rule, that basically he can't redress the government's injury because the injury is already complete. And therefore, I suspect he'll deny the request for a temporary restraining order, or putting it another way, of the prior restraint on publication.
I would agree with that. I would add that last night, Bolton's brief said that Bolton actually doesn't have any legal authority even to stop Simon & Schuster, let alone these downstream sources, Amazon and booksellers and the like. And he certainly doesn't have the legal or physical power to strip the knowledge from foreign officials. So there's that too. It's not only that it's happened, but that he really doesn't have anything he could do about it.
Although I'll just say one more thing to that. It's a little bit technical, but the government relies on Rule 65 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which basically says that an injunction against a party extends to those to non-parties who act in concert with the party. It's conceivable that if this were an ordinary Rule 65 case, that an injunction against Bolton could have an application to other parties, including maybe Amazon or Simon & Schuster. That's possible. But I really don't think the judge is going to address that, because I just don't think that relief, that enjoining Amazon and Simon & Schuster and booksellers across the country and around the world, which the court can't even do, it just can't address the harm, which is already complete.
So Ben, as we've mentioned, you have a copy of the book, you've been reading it. What's your review so far?
I have been surprised, candidly, at how boring it is. I have a high enough regard for Bolton as a mind and as a bureaucratic tactician that I actually expected to be, you know, interested in it. I think it is a badly put together piece of work product. It's badly written. It's not clear to me what he's trying to. There's not an obvious argument, and there's not a clear narrative arc to the story. So as a book, I am not an admirer of it. It does contain a rather large quantity of new information, both at the what was going on at a pedestrian bureaucratic level in any of a dozen or two dozen or three dozen policy disputes, to a pretty intense portrait of the president, to what I can only describe as the cattiest kind of drive-by shootings of other officials, particularly Jim Mattis, who he appears to detest, and Nikki Haley, for whom he has a dripping contempt that he does not explain. So it's a very weird book, and you can, I think it will be of very significant value to historians, because it, a lot of it really does read like just a data dump from his notes. And I think journalists will be poring over it to try to inform their understandings of particular episodes. But as a reader, it is much less interesting than the sum of its parts.
And so does it add anything substantial new to our understanding of the Trump presidency? I've seen a lot of discussion of people dismissing it, sort of saying, you know, okay, we get it, you know, Trump is boorish, he's ill-informed, his instincts are bad, who needs it? Like, is there immediate value to sort of observers of the Trump presidency and what Bolton has to say? Or is it really something that will be useful to, as you say, you know, historians 30 years down the line trying to unpack the details of particular events?
So I honestly think that depends where it gets discussed. So it did not portray anything about Donald Trump that the four of us would find remotely surprising. That is, he's chaotic, he's on the same side of every issue, on different sides of every issue, depending on whom he's last talked to. He's uncontrollable, he can't follow a policy process, he's very emotional in his reactions to events, you know, all of these things that, and there's just hundreds of examples of these points, some of them that are very vivid, and some of them that are like when people are going to study the Singapore summit with Kim Jong-un, this TikTok of it will be a significant document, I think. Does it tell me anything about the character of the man that I didn't already know? No. That said, if John Bolton is still welcome on Fox News, will this be a revelatory portrayal of the Trump presidency to Fox News viewers? Yeah, I think it probably will. And so I think the question really becomes, you know, does he still have entree to the audiences to whom this would actually be a different account than the one they have heard? And I don't know the answer to that question.
I take a little bit of issue with that, as Ben knows. We talked about this yesterday on his own podcast. I don't think there's anything that you could reveal about Donald Trump that would change anyone's view of Trump at all. I think that's sort of what we've been learning over and over and over again. We keep assuming this is like 1974 and the tapes will, you know, change people's views, fundamental views about the president, as they did with Richard Nixon. But I don't think that's right. I mean, I think ever since at least the Access Hollywood tape, if not before, everyone in America has known what Donald Trump is. And so I got a kick out of the NBC headline about the Bolton book two nights ago. They, in big, you know, huge headlines, the former national security advisor portrays the president as erratic, ill-informed, and putting his own interests above all else. That was the headline. You know, we waited for the Mueller report. It told us what we know about the president. It had no impact. We waited for the Ukraine revelations. It told us what we already know about the president. It had no impact. This is another example of that. The problem here is that a percentage of the electorate and a large percentage of the Republican Party officials don't care that this is the correct portrait of the president.
So yeah, so speaking of Republican Party officials, Ben, there's one more substantive question I want to ask you before we get into the legal battle, which is, as you mentioned, a lot of us were really rearing to hear from Bolton, those many months ago in the midst of the impeachment crisis, in part because of what he apparently might have had to say about Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine. So does the book add anything new to our understanding of the Ukraine matter?
You know, it presents Bolton's perspective on it, which is broadly consistent with the testimony of Alex Vindman and Fiona Hill and the other people who were, you know, on the National Security Council staff. It confirms that, you know, he said he didn't want any part of a drug deal, and it does not dispute that he said that Rudy Giuliani was a hand grenade waiting to go off. It read to me like he didn't quite remember saying that, but acknowledges it was something that he would say. And I think he writes at one point that it still rings true. You know, was clearly very disturbed by that, and disturbed by that episode in exactly the way that the other members of the people who testified were. I think really the novel feature of Bolton's account is that he sees it merely as the most developed example of a pattern of activity that in his account includes a direct one-on-one request from Trump to Xi Jinping, asking him to get involved in the 2020 election on Trump's behalf, and a one-on-one promise to President Erdogan that he would have the Halk Bank case taken care of. And this was the, you know, the Turkish bank situation that the Southern District of New York was working on, and that, you know, clearly played some role in Preet Bharara's firing a couple of years earlier. And so I think there is the innovation of it is that he actually has a higher altitude look at the problem, because he didn't only see the Ukraine situation. He also saw these other situations, and he's a very smart lawyer, and he draws these connections between them that I'm not sure that anybody else who testified was drawing. That said, his account of the Ukraine matter is a little bit less developed than some of the others, because he was less directly involved, and it's broadly consistent with, he's not taking issue with, and in fact is in certain respects specifically validating things that people testified to.
Support for today's Lawfare podcast comes from the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. As an attorney, you can help your community improve through service and the pursuit of justice. At Mitchell Hamlin, you can study the law in a way that fits your life. There are full-time and part-time options both on campus and online. The law school has an over 100-year tradition of a rigorous, practice-based approach to legal education that prepares students to add value in their communities. In addition to its JD program, Mitchell Hamlin offers legal education certifications in cybersecurity and privacy law, elder law, healthcare administration, and human resource compliance. In a time when so many law schools are switching to online platforms, Mitchell Hamlin has an established record of providing high-quality legal education in online, in-person, and blended forms. Learn more at mitchellhamlin.edu. That's mitchellhamlin.edu.
All right. So now that we have that on the table and we have a sense of sort of what it is that we're dealing with, let's turn back to the litigation. So, Jack, there are actually two different things the Justice Department is trying to do here. It's suing Bolton for breach of contract, and it's also seeking a temporary restraining order to limit the book's distribution. Can you just walk us through in a little more detail what specifically the government is trying to do here?
Bolton signed two types of non-disclosure agreements, one pertaining to classified information, which is information defined by reference to the degree of harm it would cause the national security if it were disclosed, and one with regard to the most sensitive information in the government called secure compartmentalized information, or SCI. And so he had two types of obligations about what he couldn't disclose, and each of those contracts required him to do some sort, in certain circumstances, to review information with the government before he could publish information. The government basically alleges that he breached both contracts, and they are seeking in the short term before Tuesday to enjoin him from publishing the book. And they're also asking in the longer term that all of the royalties from the book go to the government in a constructive trust rather than to Bolton, which is a typical, the second thing is a typical process when someone publishes information in violation of these contracts. The contracts provide that the government can recover the profits. So if indeed Bolton violated those contracts, he will have to give up his profits, I'm pretty sure, to the government. It's a very complex and technical question whether he did violate those contracts. It gets into lots of legal weeds. But that's down the road. There probably have to be discovery on that, and there's no huge urgency in figuring that out. What's urgent is this question for next Tuesday, whether Judge Lamberth will grant the government's request for a prior restraint on further publication of the book.
And so walk us through that question of prior restraint a little more. I think that a lot of listeners may have heard, you know, Bolton book prior restraint and thought, it's just like the Pentagon Papers case. You know, we know that under the First Amendment, the government can't do that. It's actually, as you and Marty have both written, a lot more complicated. Can you just walk us through what the sort of different First Amendment issues are here?
Sure. So the Pentagon Papers case was a case where the government tried to enjoin the Washington Post and the New York Times from publishing the Pentagon Papers that Daniel Ellsberg gave to the newspapers. And this was basically a secret history of the Vietnam War that showed the Vietnam War in a much different light than the government had been portraying it. In a very famous and important decision, the Supreme Court, it was a somewhat splintered court, but a majority clearly said that the usual rule about prior restraints, and there's a very strong, super strong presumption that the First Amendment does not allow the government to enjoin publication prior to publication. They might be able to get damages or criminal liability afterwards, but the First Amendment has a super strong presumption against allowing prior restraints. The Supreme Court said that that powerful presumption even applied in the context when the government alleged that there was national security information that might do harm to the United States. There were different opinions and different arguments, but basically some justices relied just on the First Amendment. Other justices relied on the fact that the government was claiming inherent authority to be able to enjoin the government in this context without any authorization from Congress. In any event, that's a very powerful precedent. That precedent, as Marty suggested, that precedent might not apply here because this is a different situation because of the pre-publication contracts that Bolton entered into. He pledged not to publish this information. He pledged to abide by any judicial remedies to enforce the contract. There have been cases in the past, a fair number of cases, in which courts enjoined parties who wanted to publish, enjoin them to comply with the preclearance process, enjoin them to basically said, you have to follow the process. You cannot publish without following this process. And those cases were in effect a prior restraint, showing that the Pentagon Papers precedent doesn't necessarily apply when someone has signed these contracts. If the government had brought this case, were able to bring this case 2 months ago, when the manuscript was just in Bolton's hands or had just gone to Simon and Schuster, there would have been an interesting and difficult argument whether the government could at that point have gotten a prior restraint on further publication of the book. But as we suggested at the outset, the posture of the case now is very advanced. And I think neither Marty or not, I believe that there's anything that Judge Lamberth can do in this very compressed time frame, given that the book's already been published, to give the government the relief that it wants, which is basically not to be injured by the publication of classified information.
Marty, do you want to weigh in there?
No, I would agree with all of that. The analogy here would be if in the New York Times case, the government had gone to court before Ellsberg leaked the materials, or after he leaked the materials, but was trying to enjoin Ellsberg, stop the government employee from leaking. There, the court has said that, you know, a prior restraint can be imposed on someone who has agreed not to talk like any other contract, especially where you were only able to get the information in the first place because you agreed that you would not talk. But you can't go after the people the court held in that case, the press, or here the publishers and the others, who are the recipients of the leak, effectively, if it was a leak. Now, what we're skipping over here is this very deep question about whether two questions. One is whether Bolton is violating these contracts at all. As Jack said, it's a fairly technical question. And the second is whether any of the information in the book that Ben is reading is in fact classified. And if so, when was it classified? By whom? For what reasons? Was it justified? Et cetera, et cetera. It appears that at least some of the classification occurred after Bolton was told by the career official in the NSC that his manuscript, after he had made hundreds of redactions to it, he was told that it no longer included any classified information. At that point, he told Simon & Schuster to go ahead, and it was only a subsequent review by a different official within the National Security Council that led to this conclusion just a couple of days ago, that in fact it includes classified information and even this heightened classified information that Jack referred to.
So I want to just break in and ask Ben a question. Does it seem like there's classified information in the book?
Yeah, it's very hard to know as a reader, of course. So, but here's what I can say. First of all, I don't know which six passages they're talking about. And so, you know, when you read the book, there is a huge amount of information in it that plausibly, reasonably could be understood as classified. I mean, a presidential conversation with a foreign head of state. Remember that when the Jim Comey memos were retroactively reviewed by his own staff after Comey was fired, they removed a word and retroactively classified a word here and there because it identified the country that the president was having a communication with the head of state. That happens dozens and dozens of times in this book. So if the question is, you know, if that could be retroactively up classified to the confidential level, I could see that happening over and over again in this book. That wouldn't get you to SCI material, but you know, certainly there are passages in this book that, given what's called foreign government information classification, that is pretty routine. I don't think it is per se ridiculous to say that there is that a reasonable government official might look at this book and say, hey, there's some classified material here. On the other hand, you know, the process that Marty just described, in which Bolton went back and forth for months with this official, satisfied her that all of the classified material had been removed. And then only when a second official, who is a political appointee, gets involved and redoes it, is there more information that is supposedly classified that they don't identify for months and months and months. I can totally understand Bolton's feeling of being, kind of having his chain jerked. And so I don't really know how to answer your question, Quinta, except to say there is definitely a fair bit of information in here that I have seen be considered, of a type that I have seen be considered classified in the past. It is also the type of information that the average senior public official's memoirs are replete with. And so whether there are specific passages that have specific anxieties associated with them, whether those are legitimate, I really don't know.
Ben's comment actually raises something that Jack and I have been discussing, a question we don't quite know the full answer to. It appears from in this morning's or in last night's filings, it appears that the most of the conflict between Bolton and this official for these 4 months were over communications between Donald Trump and foreign officials. And most of the remedies that she was satisfied with were him changing direct quotes to paraphrases of the president's communications, which is a little bit odd. Like, why would that make a difference in terms of national security? Ben is right that there's very little, Jack, there might be no case law and very little public understanding or writings about two questions. One, when are presidential communications with foreign officials classifiable? You know, when do they even meet the standards of classification? And two, how are they classified? Who classifies them and when and how? And there's really very little lore or understanding about those questions, interestingly, let alone about why the distinction between direct quotes and paraphrases would make such a big national security difference.
So just a couple of thoughts following up on those two comments. First, I think it's really important that we should say a little bit more about how really weird this process was. Bolton went through 4 months of preclearance review with the career official in charge of this question. Lots of redactions, lots of back and forth, taking out quotations, eliminating passages and the like. And she told him that there's no classified information in the document, not just no SCI, but no classified information. Then the political official, Michael Ellis, reviewing the career official's determination after 4 months that there was no classified information, the political official does this review, and it turns out that he completed his review on June 9th. Took about 5 weeks to review it and determine
that's last Tuesday.
last Tuesday, determined there was all this classified information in it. Marty and I asked in one of our posts, when did he receive training in proper classification and avoidance of overclassification? The government amended its complaint an hour before oral argument to say that he received that training on June 10th, one day after he completed his review. There's every reason to think that this review was extremely untoward and unusual, and may have been infected with politics precisely because they weren't following. It seems like that the political official was not following the proper rules. Second thing I'll say about SCI, and Marty and I have been discussing this as well, it's sometimes you just can't tell by reading a book. It could be that Bolton is reporting on a conversation that between him and Trump, or between Trump and an official, or about a piece of information. And it could be that the nature of that conversation reveals something about the United States collection capacities, its intelligence collection capacities, and that would inadvertently tip off an adversary about how we're collecting information. A lot of, I think, SCI review is about trying to prevent inferences by our adversaries about how we're collecting information. And so it's almost impossible for someone reading a book to be able to discern that, though, of course, the foreign adversary might be able to discern it.
And so to that point about how odd the review process was, and I'm glad we touched on that, because as you say, I think it's really important. To what extent, Jack and Marty, do you think that might affect Judge Lamberth's thinking on the question? Because he has some wiggle room here, right? He's not a rubber stamp. And as you noted in one of your pieces, he's said in the past that he felt that courts have actually been too deferential often to the executive branch. So do you think that will shape how he's thinking about the case?
I think today Judge Lamberth asked Chuck Cooper, who is Bolton's lawyer, at oral argument on the TRO matter. He asked how he was supposed, there are some affidavits in the case from senior intelligence officials, including a couple of career officials, including General Nakasone, who's the head of the National Security Agency and who's not someone who we think of as remotely political. And these national security figures said in their declarations that there was classified information in the book. And Judge Lamberth asked the question today to Chuck Cooper, how he said, I'm not going to give the government blanket deference. I'm going to have to scrutinize it myself. But how am I supposed to second guess people like General Nakasone when he says there's classified information in this document? So that's a tip off that even Lamberth is going to have trouble, may have trouble in second guessing the classified information determinations. On the other hand, in ways that are extremely complicated, I can just give you the top line, that there's a serious question about when information here was deemed classified. Ben talked about something in one of Comey's papers being classified after the fact. And the timing of classification, whether whether Ellis, the political official, classified things after the fact, whether it was after Bolton had sent it to already to Simon and Schuster and the like, the timing of when things became classified might well be very important in determining whether Bolton breached his contracts.
And on that point, Judge Lamberth actually asked the government lawyer today, when were these six passages classified? And my understanding of the answer, correct me if any of you heard it differently, was three of them were classified before Michael Ellis's recent review. And apparently they should have been picked up by the career official who was reviewing it. One of them was classified by Ellis during his review before he learned how to classify. And the other two, the lawyer had not yet figured out who classified them and when. So it was unknown. And that's a bit odd. But they are claiming that at least three passages had been previously classified and should have been caught in this process. One interesting question then is, if that's so, and let's say Lamberth says that that's right, though at least those three cases were legitimate classifications, what follows from that? And what Jack has already suggested is a preliminary injunction here probably does not, because you can't stop the damage that's already been done. So all that really leaves is whether the government could at some later point get a constructive trust for the profits that John Bolton will realize on this book. And there, the fact that he didn't know it was classified and had no reason and was actually told that it wasn't, I think would probably make it pretty hard for the government to collect his profits, even if the courts decided that they would defer to the government's classification decisions.
So yeah, Marty, can you say a little bit more about your read on sort of how Lamberth sounded today? And I also think it would be useful if you could sort of fill listeners in on what Lamberth's background is here, because the fact that Lamberth was given this case is actually quite significant.
I think maybe Ben would be better to speak to Lamberth's background and character. I mean, he's known as a somewhat iconoclastic judge, a judge who lets, in his opinions and often in the courtroom, is very candid about his views and can be very, very sharp with government lawyers in particular. His politics, I think, are eclectic and not obvious. They're difficult to parse sometimes. And I don't think he has any particular philosophy other than, as you mentioned, he has publicly suggested that there's overclassification and overdeference to the government on classification. Today, I thought he was actually not really tipping his hand. He's really trying to gather information and figure all this out, something that's very difficult to do in these situations where all the briefs are being sort of thrown. It would be bad enough in an ordinary situation where you're getting paper copies of the briefs in your courtroom, but it's all this sort of electronic filings just hours before an argument with classified and unclassified affidavits. It took Jack and I hours to make some sense of it. He has to do much more than that. And it's difficult. So I think he was actually playing the role a district court judge best plays, which is just trying to figure out the facts.
Yeah, I agree with that characterization. He was very candid about how hard it would be for him to second guess determinations of classified information by these career intelligence officials. And it seemed to me in his questioning of Bolton's lawyer, Chuck Cooper, he seemed to me, at least atmospherically, a little skeptical of Bolton's claims that the contract wasn't breached here. And Cooper and he spent a lot of time going through the non-disclosure agreements. But there's a long way to go in this case in terms of figuring out the facts of what happened in this classification process and really parsing these agreements before we have any sense of whether Bolton's going to be able to keep the money or whether the government's going to get it. I mean, typically the government does not have a hard time in collecting royalties when someone publishes something in breach of these non-disclosure agreements. It hasn't been hard. They just collected some Snowden's profits on the book he published. And I think that the betting money would have to be that ultimately the government will be able to get his profits. But this case seems much more complicated and difficult for the government because of these untoward processes, because the contracts have some loopholes in them. So I just think it's too early to tell. And Lamberth really ultimately didn't tip his hand today.
Yeah, let me just add a couple notes about Lamberth. you know, which is among federal district judges, he's probably one of the a very small number with the most experience with classified information. And the reason is that he was the presiding judge of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for a number of years. And in addition, I may be getting this wrong, but I don't think so. I believe he had some of the Iran-Contra defendants, some of the lesser known Iran-Contra defendants, and had to do a very large quantity of litigation under the Classified Information Procedures Act in connection with those cases. Take that with a grain of salt, but I believe that's correct. And so this is a judge with a lot of granular experience with classified materials and sort of unusual amount for a district judge, and who's also, as Marty rightly points out, notably tough on government lawyers. He used to run, back when he was at the U.S. Attorney's Office, he ran the civil side of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, and so he kind of has a very high standard that he holds government lawyers to in his courtroom. And so he's, you know, you put that together, that he's, you know, sophisticated about classified information, has a lot of experience with classified information, and takes a certain amount of pleasure in giving government lawyers a hard time. And I think this is a very good, if you're Chuck Cooper, who represents John Bolton, and you get Royce Lamberth on the wheel on this case, you are very pleased with that. One other point, just to draw on Marty's point, you know, if their contention is that three of these are later up classifications, and only three of these passages were classified in real time, and the government official who reviewed it initially told Bolton that there was no classified material in it, you do get into this question of, as Marty points out, what he reasonably could have been expected to know. And, you know, I would think you would need a fair bit of discovery to figure out what the sequence of events are to determine whether his conduct was a brazen defiance of his obligations under the non-disclosure agreements, or whether it was a kind of good faith, I'll work with you for months and months and months, and at the end of the day, you're not telling me that there's any passages that are classified. You're retroactively classifying some material, and you're telling me that material that was already told to me was unclassified is now classified. And I could see that really rubbing somebody like Lamberth the wrong way.
So we're almost out of time, but I want to close with a question that has been bothering me, and after talking through all this with you, is still bothering me, which is, why did the government file suit now? You've all kind of touched on this in terms of in our conversation, you know, that perhaps the government could have put this litigation on the table much earlier, but they're suing now when, whatever metaphor you want to use, the horse has left the barn, the toothpaste has left the tube. Is it just a sort of a performance to kind of make some Sturm und Drang? Do they not actually care if the book is out there? I'd love to hear any of your thoughts on what on earth is going on here.
So I actually think it makes some sense that they didn't sue until now. So here, just because of the sequence of the events, it's April 27th or early May that Ms. Knight tells Bolton that there's nothing classified in it, and she suggests that they're going to give him a letter to that effect virtually immediately, and they don't. And so he starts emailing her, like, what's up? When can I get my letter to go? And at that point, it's obvious that she's been told just to stonewall him, because he gets pro forma responses and no answer back. So then he tells Simon & Schuster, go ahead. You know, they're just not responding to me anymore. And that's when Michael Ellis begins his review process. And it wasn't until Ellis concluded, apparently, that things were classified in there, which seems to have been in the last 10 days, that I think that they would have had any grounds to sue, right? If they hadn't found any classified information, it would have been a ridiculous lawsuit. But it's when Ellis finally concludes that it's classified about a month after he begins the review and 2 weeks before the publication date that they send a letter to Chuck Cooper saying, there's classified information in here. You can't go forward. Cooper responds, give me a break. We're going ahead. This is ridiculous. And then they sue. So I actually think that makes sense. I don't think they were holding off on the lawsuit for tactical reasons or something like that.
But it still might be performance art because...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm just saying why it wasn't done earlier.
Yeah, they would have had a hard time doing it earlier because it was only recently that they determined that there was classified information in the book. But there's a large question. There's no doubt that they were going to sue Bolton to try to get the profits. But why you bring a request for a prior restraint, and by the way, a request for an unprecedentedly broad prior restraint. There's never been, the government has never sought a prior restraint on this scale, a restraint not just on Bolton, but also on the publisher, on the distributors, on the booksellers and the like. Why you bring that scale of prior restraint this late, for whatever reason you had to delay, knowing that the injury is complete. And apparently, according to the New York Times, there was a huge debate in the Justice Department about whether to bring the TRO, the temporary restraining order. And we could all be wrong. It's possible that Lamberth will grant this prior restraint, but I don't think so. And so it's a bit of a puzzle, and especially since the government has already had to amend its complaint and admit some embarrassing facts that it would have gotten straight if it had taken its time more. It's not clear why they brought this TRO, that they're pretty certainly going to lose, and the case is going to be framed less favorably to them than it would have been, other than, you know, just to show we're doing everything we can to stop Bolton, even if it's a futile act. And I'll just say one more thing. There is also a question, I doubt it, but there's also a question whether they will prosecute Bolton. I'm sure that's being considered inside the Justice Department. I'm sure, and that would be a very serious thing that we haven't really analyzed much yet.
Jack, on that question, don't you think the fact that it would be very hard for them to show that he knew he was disclosing classified information, let alone information that would satisfy the terms of the Espionage Act, that kind of prosecution. I mean, they might file it anyway for theater.
I agree.
But winning that suit would be...
I agree. I predicted a week ago that they would not file such a suit, and I don't think they will file a suit. But given that they filed this TRO that they're certainly going to lose, and given that they may be operating on dimensions other than trying to win the case, maybe they want to cause Bolton pain on another dimension.
All right. Well, we will have to wait and see. And it does seem like there's certainly no end of excitement in this case in the future. Thank you all for joining.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and our audio engineer for this episode was Ian Enright. Our producer is Jen Pacha Howell. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast on whatever app you use, and thanks for listening.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.